Today on the TV Time Machine, we welcome Mark Duidziak, author of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone. Mr. Duidziak is also author of The Columbo File, The Night Stalker Companion, and is a legendary TV critic for the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper. Over the next segment, Mark Duidziak will talk about his book, Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, which explores the life lessons that can be learned from this classic TV series. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to witness the self-improvement of Mark Duidziak, feel free to experience a world of difference as we look at a mirror image of ourselves in the present in order to realize that people are alike all over in the past. Mark, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Now, you're the author of the book, Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone. So, Mark, tell us about yourself and what your Twilight Zone book is all about.
Well, you know, there's been so much written on the Twilight Zone that you can't sort of just presume that you're just going to sit out to write a Twilight Zone book. There has to be a very compelling reason for it. And this one... You know, somebody asked me the other day how long it took me to write this book. I was at a book fair, and I jokingly said, well, there are two answers to that. One is my entire life. And that's a long answer, but it's not really a wrong answer because there's about a lifetime of thought has gone into this book. But, you know, the answer they wanted was how long did it take you from a writing process? And, you know, this process started in 2000. Becky was 15. My daughter was 15, and she had just turned 15, and I thought she should send. So Becky's 21, so that'll give you an idea of the time frame we're talking about here.
Wow.
And Becky, you know, had watched a lot of classic TV at this point. She had watched the Dick Van Dyke Show. She had watched I Love Lucy. She had watched the Andy Griffith Show. She had a lot of favorites. You know, for a while. You know, I say this in the book, but the joke around our house was that, you know, Becky was going to be shocked to find out they were making TV in color because so much of her viewing diet was black and white. And then, you know, she started to watch color stuff like Columbo, of course. She was going to get Columbo and Night Stalker. But one of the things she really liked, she enjoyed, and you're going to like this, was Night Gallery.
Oh, yes. I like that show.
She really watched Night Gallery first. And... she enjoyed it. She really enjoyed the better episodes of Night Gallery and went back and rewatched them a few times. So when she was 15, I said, well, you know, you like Night Gallery a lot. I think you're kind of done with your undergraduate work in classic TV. It's time to start your postgraduate work, and you really need to enter the Twilight Zone. So we decided to watch all 156 episodes in order. So, you know, we got the box sets down, and we started with the pilot, and we worked our way all the way through. And we hit very quickly a first-season episode, an early first-season episode called Escape Clause, with David Wayne as the hypochondriac who sells his soul to the devil in exchange for immortality. And, you know, if you have any experience with the Twilight Zone at all, you know this is not going to end well for David
right.
Wayne. So, you know, but when we got to the end... I jokingly turned to Becky and I wagged an admonishing finger at her and said, jokingly, you just let that be a lesson to you. Always read contracts. Read every get a contract. Don't sign anything without knowing. And then, you know, I kind of stopped and thought about the banking crisis and how many people signed contracts without knowing what they'd signed.
Right.
And how much trouble that got us into. And I turned back to Becky and said, you know, now half jokingly, no, really, I mean this. You know, I'm serious about this. And well, this became a running gag in our house. After every episode, I'd say, let that be a lesson to you. But it was sort of a launching pad for us to talk about what was really going on behind the fantasy, what metaphorically was going on, what life lesson was there, what moral was there. Now, I'm a slow learner, Jim. It took me a few weeks before the penny actually dropped, and having these discussions with Becky before I finally realized, you know, you got a book in this, stupid. If you know, this is it. This is your moment. Don't you understand this? And this goes back to that question of how long did it take you to write the book. The dream of my youth was to write the history of the Twilight Zone. And I actually set this as a goal of mine when I was living and working in Upper East Tennessee at a newspaper called the Kingsport Times News, circulation 50,000. I was working on my very first book, which was a history of the Barter Theater, a regional theater in Southwest Virginia. And I knew my next book was going to be about the Twilight Zone. I was going to be the guy to write that history. And you and I both understand something here, which is
yes,
Upper East Tennessee is probably not the best place to write a history of the Twilight Zone.
That's true.
But, you know, enough interviews checked in to make me pretend I was writing that book. Donna Douglas came to town.
Wow.
And she was shooting a commercial for for mobile homes, and she was dressed as Ellie Mae Clampett. And I ran down to the filming site, and I talked to Donna Douglas and talked to her about Rod Serling and Eye of the Beholder. Two people who were at the Barter Theater, the book I was researching, Claude Akins and Fritz Weaver, were on the Twilight Zone, and I interviewed them.
Wow.
So I was doing enough to sort of kid myself, but then you know what happened. In 1982, I walked into a bookstore, and what did I see?
Right. The Twilight Zone Companion.
By Mark Scott Security.
That's right.
And I couldn't even be mad because Mark had done such a good job on
right.
that book.
Exactly.
I couldn't even be angry about it because when I read the book, I realized I would have never have done anything near as the landmark work that book did. And
well, that was a revolutionary book because he changed the very form of how television
right.
was written about in books by the very structure he used.
And indirectly influenced what did become my second book, because I immediately, being a practical person, set my sights on my second favorite TV show. And you know where this is leading.
Columbo.
Exactly. And my goal was to do as good a book on Columbo as Mark had done on The Twilight Zone.
Which you did.
The bar had been set by a book which had taken a TV show so seriously
right.
that I knew that if I was going to write a book on Columbo, it wasn't just going to be compared to other TV books. It was going to be compared to that book.
Right.
So, but all the while, you know, and the next book was the Night Stalker history, was the Kolchak history. And that kind of got me back into genre. That kind of got me where I wanted to be all along. And that led me to write other books in genre, books about Dracula, books about Richard Matheson. And I was slowly working my way. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was working my way back to the Twilight Zone. And all through this time, as silly as this is going to sound, and I understand how silly it does sound, I thought I was owed a Twilight Zone book.
I agree.
And so then I start sharing this with my daughter. I come up with this idea. I take it to my agent, who says, I think it's a good idea. She takes it to St. Martin's, and they say, we think it's a good idea. And lo and behold, I got my Twilight Zone. So that's basically a very long answer to your question.
Well, you mentioned Becky started watching The Twilight Zone around the age of 15 after Night Gallery. When you were growing up, what episodes of The Twilight Zone stood out most for you and really had an impact on you?
I started watching The Twilight Zone. I was not old enough to watch it in the original run. I mean, I technically was old enough. But I was born in 1956, and the show started in 59. So at the tail end of its run, I could have been watching it. But I really didn't turn into a horror fan or somebody who was interested in spooky stuff until the age of 7. So I really started watching The Twilight Zone when it hit rerun, and it hit rerun immediately. In New York, WPIX Channel 11 started rerunning The Twilight Zone on a regular basis. So I was about 9, right after its original run, that I discovered The Twilight Zone. And I loved The Twilight Zone because I was a horror kid. I was a Universal, Hammer, Dark Shadows horror kid. So I was watching The Twilight Zone because of those creep-out endings. That's what I liked about it. I didn't know there was any metaphoric storytelling going on. I didn't know that there were morals and life lessons in here. I just loved that creepy feeling where the hairs on the back of your neck would go up at the end. And that was why I was watching. And it was the only reason I was. I love The Twilight Zone. It became my favorite show. It has remained my favorite show. But to say that at 9 or 10 years old, that I understood what was really going on would be the grossest overstatement in the world. I was watching it on one level only. And I adored it. So the episodes that stood out to me were the ones that I thought were the creepiest. And to this day, you know, the things you see in your youth always have the most impact. The movie that scared you the most when you were 7 or 8 years old. So to me, two of the episodes that have stayed with me for a long time, they were among the first I saw. But 22.
Right.
The one about the performer who is in the hospital, and she keeps going, waking from a dream and going down to the morgue, and the creepy nurse comes out and keeps saying, "We're room for one more, honey.
Room for one more, honey."
This is Miss Liz Powell. She's a professional dancer. She's in the hospital as a result of overwork and nervous fatigue. And at this moment, we have just finished walking with her in a nightmare. In a moment, she'll wake up and will remain at her side. The problem here is that both Miss Powell and you will reach a point where it might be difficult to decide which is reality and which is nightmare. A problem uncommon, perhaps, but rather peculiar to The Twilight Zone.
Right, and let me guess, the second one was Ring-A-Ding Girl.
It was, right. Yeah. And both of those because I thought they were extraordinarily unnerving, creepy episodes, and I still think they're very creepy episodes. If I were to make a list today of my top 10 episodes or my the 10 episodes I think were the greatest episodes of all time, I wouldn't put either of those in the top 10. But they had an enormous impact on me when I was a kid.
And they both involve aircraft.
And I'm not scared of flying.
Okay.
So I've flown my entire life, but I have no fear of flying at all. And that's exactly right. You know, and today, one of the episodes I would put in the top 10 is Nightmare 20,000 Feet.
Right.
But no, I think there were other aspects of it that I thought were creepy. Almost like a bizarre surrealism to both episodes that I think was more creepy than the fact that there was an airplane involved in both. But I continued, like, I carried The Twilight Zone, so I started rewatching the episodes whenever they were on. So I was seeing them as a teenager and then as a young adult, and then gradually I started to realize there's a lot more going on here than just the creep out O. Henry twist ending here. You know, Rod Serling is making a point in almost, or not just Rod Serling, because I never wanted to be, Rod wrote more than 90 episodes of 156, so he is clearly the principal voice. He was the executive producer, he was the showrunner, he was the narrator, he was host, and he was the lead writer. So, you know, he had a lot to do and say in the shaping of it, but often enough, people will credit something to Rod, which was really Richard Matheson,
right,
or Charles Beaumont,
right,
or George Clayton Johnson or Earl Hamner. So there was an amazing group of writers working on that show. And they all contributed something that we think of as The Twilight Zone.
Well, you mentioned that The Twilight Zone is, of course, allegorical. So why did Rod Serling create The Twilight Zone? What was his primary motivation?
Well, I love this because I think people think that there's a F. Scott Fitzgerald line that there are no second acts in American lives, which is nonsense. They're, Americans love second acts. We're a nation of second acts.
We have
seconds, and that the great thing about is that for Rod Serling, The Twilight Zone was the second act. He had already had a very acclaimed full career as a writer for the great live anthology shows of television in the 1950s. He and Patty Chayefsky are unquestionably the two best known angry young writers who emerged from that amazing group of writers, which included Gore Vidal and Horton Foote, J.P. Miller, Reginald Rose. And these two emerged as the leading voices of that era. And but the difference is that you're going into the 1950s. When Rod Serling starts his career in the 1950s, television's the Wild West. Television is the newcomer. And they're making it up as they go along. There are very few rules. They are establishing the rules. They're making the rules. By the end of the 50s, TV is a very, very different medium. And it's nothing but rules. By the end of the 50s, it has become, you can't say this because the sponsor will get upset. You can't say this because these stations in this area of the country are going to get upset. You can't say that because we've got an advertiser who will object. And Rod was getting increasingly frustrated with getting the message across. So he sneaks into the Twilight Zone. He creates the Twilight Zone as a way of writing about the very exact same thing. That's the one thing about Rod Serling. You can see him from the very beginning of his career, his earliest writings, all the way to the end through Night Gallery and beyond. His themes don't change. Rod's themes remain the same. He's interested in the same things. He just finds different ways to write about them. And he takes these themes and he goes into the Twilight Zone. And he gambles on the idea that if it's all couched in fantasy, nobody will raise an eyebrow. And he was absolutely right. There's this wonderful interview, I'm sure you've seen it, right before the Twilight Zone aired, where he sits down with Mike Wallace.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And, you know, they're both smoking away like stacks. You know?
That's true.
I don't know how you can even see them in this interview.
That's true.
But it's on YouTube if anybody wants to go check it out. But there's this wonderful moment where Mike Wallace says, in his typically snarky Mike Wallace way, you know, "Well, Rod, you're doing this thing called the Twilight Zone, and I assume that means you're done with serious writing for a while."
You've sold out.
And the camera sort of zooms in on Rod, and he's got this look on his face like the cat that just ate the canary. But the magician cannot show his trick. The magician cannot say, you know, "I'm about to fool you, and this is how." So Rod says, "Yes, Mike, you're right. I'm." and we all know what he's about to do is pull off the great trick of all time. He's not done with serious writing. He's just getting going.
So is that why in your book you describe Rod Serling as the moralist in disguise?
Oh yeah, that phrase comes from Mark Twain. It actually comes from a letter. A little girl in France named Helene Picard had written Mark Twain a letter late in his career. And, you know, at this point, Mark Twain was basically known as a kind of grandfatherly, avuncular man of letters, a humorist. He was, you know, a family author and a funny man. And this little girl had written him a letter and said, I love your writing, but I detect behind all of the joking, you're actually a very serious man. And Twain wrote her back a letter. In which he basically said to her, "You're right, but don't tell anybody. I'm a moralist in disguise." And I love that phrase came, shoo, when I started to sit down to write this book, that phrase came, you know, like a heat-seeking missile, came back to me. And I thought, that's Rod. Rod is just using fantasy to do what Twain did with humor.
Right,
which is to couch, you know, George Bernard Shaw once said of Mark Twain that he taught him the most valuable lesson of all, which is if you're going to tell people the truth about themselves, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you.
Right, that's true.
And I think Rod realized that if you're going to tell people the truth about themselves, if you're not going to make them laugh, then you have to make them sort of have their mouths hanging open with a sense of wonder and awe, which is what the Twilight Zone did. So Rod's themes, you look at the Twilight Zone, are there messages about prejudice and ignorance and hatred and greed? Are there messages about how we treat the elderly? And all these themes Rod's been writing about all along. Yeah, you know, hasn't changed his theme, you know. He just carries them into the Twilight Zone and finds a much more powerful venue for them. Not just a more powerful venue for them, but, I mean, if there's not a Twilight Zone, we're still talking about Rod Serling as this wonderful writer from the 1950s who did Patterns and A Requiem for a Heavyweight. But he's not a household name. and he's not a celebrity, and he is not, and he is just a matter of curiosity for students of the medium and maybe some people in academia.
Right.
But because of the Twilight Zone, he reached an audience that went across political boundaries. It goes across every social boundary and generational, because my students, they don't know anything else in black and white, but they know the Twilight Zone.
We're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with Mark Dowidziak, author of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.
This is one of the out-of-the-way places. The unvisited places. Bleak, wasted, dying. This is a farmhouse. Handmade, crude. A house without electricity or gas. A house untouched by progress. This is the woman who lives in the house. A woman who's been alone for many years. A strong, simple woman whose only problem up until this moment has been that of acquiring enough food to eat. A woman about to face terror, which is, even now, coming at her from the Twilight Zone.
We're back again with Mark Dowidziak, author of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, who is riding along with us on the TV Time Machine. He had such an iconic presence when he was doing the Twilight Zone. He had such a unique way of hosting that show. I guess the only parallel would be Alfred Hitchcock in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But the fact that he was so serious and buttoned down and stark in a sense made such an impression, which, of course, allowed a lot of people to make impressions of him. So when you were watching Rod Serling host The Twilight Zone, how did that strike you, especially as a young person growing up?
You know, I've talked to other writers who have said this. Is that, you know, the notion that you can identify a writer by the way they look and sound and talk, that's almost unheard of in the history of the world. You know, Rod Serling was writing at a point in time when the average American couldn't have picked Norman Mailer out of a police lineup.
Right.
You know, and to this day, I mean, could the average American identify Dostoevsky or Melville or Hawthorne? You know, Mark Twain and Rod Serling shared something else, which was they were true 14-carat celebrities.
Right.
They were the most recognized writer of the planet on the planet during their lifetimes. There's no even close second. And, you know, television did. It was what did it for Rod Serling. But because of that, a lot of people of my generation saw a writer, saw somebody in that. There was a role model there. There was some. You could be a writer, and you could be somebody telling these wonderful stories and reaching people and making a difference. And I have heard a lot of people told me over the years they became writers because Rod Serling explained to them there was something called a writer.
Right.
There was something like this that you could do, and I think that had an enormous impact on me. I think Mark Twain and Rod Serling probably did have the two for me had the two greatest impacts, and you know they're both heroic figures, at least in my mind they are. You know, I grew up of a generation which is not different in America in a sense from the same way my father grew up and the next generation grew up, which was we were all kind of given entertainment which said that a hero was somebody who solved a problem with a gun. Everybody we knew who were our heroes on TV, you know, the generation in front of us, you know, had a lot of cowboys, whether it was Gene Autry or Roy Rogers or Tom Mix or whoever. And the next, you know, whether it was Bogart, whether it was the detectives on TV, everybody, you know, and then the next generation, I mean, they just had a substitute. They had a gun substitute of some kind. You know, Star Wars, we might call them blasters, or in Star Trek, we call them phasers.
Right.
But everybody, you know, was good with a gun. And that continued. That continued in the comedies and movies and, you know, action movies and such. And I'm not even putting that down. I don't want this to sound like some kind of cry against, you know, guns or anything like that.
Well, for Rod Serling,
because
his pen was mightier than the gun.
Right. But the truth is, a lot of people we ask to carry guns are heroes.
Right.
You know, including people I'm related to.
Right.
So what we were being given was not exactly wrong on a lot of occasions. However, one thing that Mark Twain and Rod Serling gave me was the notion that you could carry ideas. And that could be as powerful as carrying a gun. And that the pen could be mightier than the sword. And I think that that is one thing which, you know, if you were to ask me my heroes when I was 7, 8, or 9, I probably would have named somebody who carried a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people would, because those were the heroes that were given to us.
Right.
You know, if you asked me the same question 7 years later, 14, 15, you know, my heroes had become writers. And I say this in the book, but my heroes have always been writers. You know, and that's remained true. And I think Rod Serling had a lot to do with that.
So we were talking before about book structure. For your book, Everything I Need to Know, I Learned in the Twilight Zone, how did you decide upon the structure that you applied to this work?
When I set out to do the book, I wanted to do 50 life lessons. I decided, you know, it just sounded like a good round number. I knew I wanted this to be an excuse to, because, you know, I mean, this is, in some ways, this is an easy book to describe. In some ways, it's tough because it's kind of like I describe the book as a celebration of the Twilight Zone disguised as a self-help book.
Right.
You know, the self-help elements of this are somewhat lighthearted, but there is a serious undertone to saying that all these episodes did have some kind of great metaphorical, allegorical meanings. So I knew that I wanted this to be 50 life lessons, but I also knew I wanted to have my say on the Twilight Zone and Rod Serling. So there's a long chapter about Rod Serling, and there's a long chapter about the legacy of the Twilight Zone. And then as I started writing the book, that's how the book was sold, was on the 50 life lessons. And I figured I can get most of the episodes covered. I think I got about 100 of the episodes in there in one way or another talking about them. I said, I can cover a good deal of territory with 50 life lessons, and it'll get the point across. It doesn't have to be comprehensive. You can't be comprehensive. This is not every lesson that's applicable, because anybody could look at an episode and see another equally valid lesson in it. So these are my lessons, and therefore it's going to be a very personal book. I wanted this book to be, above all, conversational. I wanted this book to be the type of book that you picked up and felt like you were talking with another Twilight Zone enthusiast or a potential Twilight Zone enthusiast. And that was, you know, sort of the goal. Right. So I knew this was going to be my most personal book. I knew that from the start, and that's what the publisher wanted. And then as I started the book, something came along for the ride, which was the guest lessons, you know, which you contributed one. And
thank you.
I wanted the book to have something a little bit extra. But also to point out that I do, you know, hubris is a bad thing in the Twilight Zone. Take hubris into the Twilight Zone,
yes. Oh, yes.
You're going to get it, you know. So one of the things I wanted to knock down in this book and open it up somewhat is to say, look, you know, these are my life lessons. But look at the number of viewpoints there are out there. Look at the infinite. If the Twilight Zone truly is as vast as space and as timeless as infinity, and it is, then the lessons have to be endless, and they are. So right. Interpretations have to be endless. So I went to Twilight Zone and Rod Serling experts, people who had been connected to the show, and people who I learned were Twilight Zone fans, you know, and some of those were surprises. I did not know Mel Brooks was a tremendous Twilight Zone fan.
Wow.
But he is.
Wow.
he's a complete nut for the Twilight Zone. In more ways than one, but in this case, he was the first guest lesson in the book, because I said to him, you know, this was actually on the phone, and I said, I hear you're a great Twilight Zone fan. Oh, yeah, I love the Twilight Zone. and I said, have you got a guest lesson? He just started talking. He didn't even have to stop and think about it. What he said to me verbatim is what's in the book. And it's beautiful. It's just gorgeous. So, you know, and then other people would suggest people. You know, somebody I said, did you know Neil deGrasse Tyson's a big Twilight Zone fan? No. So, you know, I fell a little short on that. To be perfectly honest, I would have liked there to have been 50 guest lessons, too. You know, I started a little late because that idea came to me late. So there are 33 guest lessons in the book, and, you know, and they're scattered throughout the book. You know, if I'd had my way, there would have been 17 more. But I thought that was a very nice way. I'll give you an example. I, for the life of me, could not think of a life lesson to apply to the invaders. Now, Richard Matheson was a dear friend. It's one of my favorite episodes. It's an iconic episode. Agnes right. Moorhead's performance is rightly acclaimed. But I, for the life of me, could not think of a life lesson to what? Don't be caught in an isolated farmhouse when there's an alien invasion. What lessons put on that? And I was saying, but then I was thinking, like, how can you do a book on the Twilight Zone and not have the invaders? And beyond sure. that, I have a great still from the invaders. So the get two of my guest lessons, Neil deGrasse Tyson,
right,
and then David Bean Cooley, the TV historian and critic,
That's right.
Both checked in wanting the invaders as their guest lesson. I said, oh, boy. I get my picture and I get my invaders in this book. But it also shows how they saw something in that episode that I didn't see.
So what did they see?
The sense of again, hubris, that we think we're the only the biggest things in the planet, but look, there's something bigger.
Right.
Much bigger. they saw interpretations there, which, you know, as soon as they said it, it had the realm of great common sense.
We're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with Mark Dawidziak, author of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.
Books and 2 cent fines and pamphlets and closed stacks and the musty insides of a language factory that spews out meaningless words on an assembly line. Words, Mr. Wordsworth, that have no substance and no dimension, like air, like the wind, like a vacuum that you make believe has an existence by scribbling index numbers on little cards.
I don't care. I tell you, I don't care. I'm a human being. I exist. And if I speak one thought aloud, that thought lives, even after I'm shoveled into my grave.
We're back again with Mark Dawidziak, author of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, who is riding along with us on the TV Time Machine.
And it was right there, and it had to be kind of pointed out, you know, and other writers have said this about different books over the years. And for me, you know, this moment came when somebody said to me, I love this book because there's this whole father-daughter thing going on in the book. And I said, what are you talking about?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, it had to be pointed out. And the more I thought about it, the more true it became. The book begins with the daughter and it ends with the father.
Right.
Now, that's literally true because the book begins with a wonderful foreword by Anne Serling.
That's right.
Rod's daughter, who is a wonderful writer. And so it begins with the daughter. It ends because the last thing in the book, which is another gift from the Twilight Zone, is the last lesson in the book, if you will, the last guest lesson, is from Rod Serling.
Yeah, right.
It comes from a speech he gave in Akron, Ohio, in March of 1971. And somebody sent me a recording of it. Somebody had a little reel-to-reel tape recorder.
Wow.
Sat in the audience, had taped it, then transferred that over to a cassette, had sent it to me years ago. I'd forgotten all about it. And I found it when I was looking for something else, and I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, this cassette that said Rod Serling. I said, what is this? It's his speech from 1971.
Wow.
And that last lesson comes from the last few minutes of that speech.
Wow.
And it's wonderful. It's beautiful. And it was the perfect way to end the book, and it was a gift from Rod Serling.
Hmm.
So the book begins with the daughter, and it ends with the father. But it also begins with the daughter because it began with me sharing the Twilight Zone with my daughter, Becky, and the book's dedicated to
that's
her.
That's right. That's right.
And it ends, the last thing in the book beyond what Rod wrote is the author's photo. And the author's photo was taken by Becky. So who's a very fine photographer too. So the book begins with sharing this with it, and it ends with my picture taken by Becky. But even more to bring this home, if you will, because this literally brings it home, that picture is very tightly cropped. If you see the full version of that picture, you might recognize where I am. I'm in Recreation Park in Binghamton.
Oh.
I'm standing on the bandstand where in the park where Rod used to play as
right.
a little boy,
right,
which then became the inspiration for Walking Distance. And in the background, you could see a carousel. So the picture was taken by Becky in Recreation Park where Rod played as a little boy. Mm. And, you know, this had to be pointed out to me. I didn't do any of that by, you know, design. You know, we're in Binghamton, you know, and I said, let's have the author's photo taken in Recreation Park. But, you know, there's no design to this. Like, you know, but somebody else pointed that out, that the book is in many ways structured by the father-daughter dynamic. And I thought, you know, there's
so
something
to
that.
Do you think that maybe you did that subconsciously? You just weren't mm-hmm. consciously aware of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, and some of this was managed by the Twilight, by the way.
Right.
Some of this is Rod's doing because... I was obviously going to ask Anne to write the foreword because I was so impressed by Anne's book on her dad.
Right.
I thought, you know, that is such a wonderful book.
One of the best written books ever.
Yeah. So yeah. That, you know, was, you know, I was going to ask Anne. So that was just logic. I mean, that was not part of the design. And it wasn't even subconscious, you know. And when I found that, you know, when I say I found that, I have I'm sort of underselling that story a little bit, is that, in the 1980s, you know, and I was working at the Akron Beacon Journal at the time. I was their TV critic. And, you know, a lot of people knew that I was greatly enamored of The Twilight Zone and Rod Serling. I had made no secret about it. So somebody who lived in Akron, knowing of that, had the recording that had been made in 1971. And he made a cassette for me, and he had sent it to me. And I had never listened to it. I had put it away. Always intending to listen to it. I'll get to it. And then when I was doing this book, one of the things I did with the guest lessons was I went back and listened to all of the interviews that I had done for The Twilight Zone, thinking, is there a guest lesson which was supplied by somebody years ago in the discussion? I'll bet there's one or two.
Right.
You know? And the first one I went looking for was because I interviewed him the most was Jack Klugman, because I had interviewed Jack three times at great length, not just about The Twilight Zone, but about Odd Couple and Quincy and other things. And I literally found that cassette. You know, because I'd thrown nothing out. I'm a pack rat. I live by two guiding principles of my life. Pack rats never starve, and a moving target is hard to hit. So I knew I had it, and there was a box of cassettes, old cassette tapes with interviews on them. And I find the Klugman thing. I find my Klugman tapes, and I take out the first one, put it in, hit the fast forward button on the old tape recorder. It goes whirring forward. I stopped, and it literally stopped on the perfect lesson.
Wow.
Jack is talking, and it's what's in the book. It's exactly what's in the book. I'm not making this up. It's the whole thing where Jack basically said, you know, one of the great lessons I learned was that there were three writers who suited me the best, Neil Simon, Clifford Odets, and Rod Serling, and this is why.
Right.
And that's what's in the book. And I thought, well, that's fine. So I'm putting the cassette back. And as I'm putting the cassette back, I'm looking at the cassettes that are next to it. And the cassette that's right next to it says, Jonathan Harris. Oh, that's right. I interviewed Jonathan Harris for about an hour
right.
in Pasadena once. And he told great stories about working with Lou Costello on the GE Electric Theater, and we talked about all sorts of things. There's no way we didn't talk about The Twilight. No,
right, because he was in the silence and 22.
Right,
yeah.
And so I listened, and sure enough, he hit this moment where he's talking about The Twilight Zone, and you know, and it's a perfect guest lesson as well. And I thought, oh, I'm hot now, you know. So I put that cassette back. And I look at it, and the next one says Kevin McCarthy.
Wow.
I thought, that's right.
Walter Jameson.
I interviewed Kevin in 2001, and we talked about two things: Invasion of the Body Snatchers
and the Twilight Zone.
So I get digging into this one, and I listen. Now, unfortunately, I wouldn't push it. It was a wonderful interview, and some of the interview ended up in the chapter on Walter Jameson.
Right.
But there was no real life lesson there. And I wasn't going to say, so I struck out on that one. You know? So now I'm putting that cassette back. And as I'm putting that cassette back, a stack of cassettes in the box falls over. And I'm looking at the cassette that says Rod Serling.
Whoa.
And I said, what is that? And I thought, oh, yeah.
The Akron
this
thing.
This was the copy of the speech that guy sent. So I popped it and I listened to it, and it was amazing. It was like spending an hour and a half in Rod's company.
Wow.
Just him talking to these students, the sellout crowd in March of 1971. And we get to the end, and the end is so sublime. It is so beautifully, eloquently constructed that I realize I have the ending of my book.
Wow, that's great.
And now, that's not subconscious. That's what we call a twilight zone.
That's right.
That's what we call when people say, oh, I'm having a real twilight zone. You know, and I have a lot of them. I document them in the book. When they happen, I put them in the book and said, you know, this just happened. You know, I mean, I wouldn't push those either. If it happened, it happened. It is literally true. I started writing the chapter on Rod Serling on the anniversary of his death.
Right.
Which is not just the anniversary of his...
The 40th anniversary.
Yeah.
Yes.
40th anniversary, and which led me to remember where I was on that day, and I happened to be driving through upstate New York. I was not that far from Rochester, where Rod died. I was driving a 1970 Cutlass. Old couple. So, and all of a sudden I remembered exactly where I was when the radio, because you know there are no CD players or cassette players in cars then. You know, you're lucky if you had a radio. And the radio came out with, you know, Rod Serling just died in Rochester, New York, and I, you know, it just took the wind out of my sails. You know, completely. So. That, you know, does that, you know, did I stage manage that? No. would I have stage managed it? You know, absolutely not. Did it happen? Yes. You know, so there are these kind of Twilight Zone moments which occurred throughout the writing of the book, and I would just go ahead and write them down and document.
So, Mark, what are some of the life lessons in Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone that are particularly personal and meaningful to you?
Now, that's a good question. That is a really, really good question. And I would say, you know, there are a lot of things which either reflect long-held beliefs, and there are long-held beliefs because of the Twilight Zone. You know, one of my favorite episodes is the first one. I made the first one the life lesson for a reason. And it's the life lesson that I derived from The Big Tall Wish.
Right.
You know, and it's something I say, you know, that I've always, you know, greatly believed, which is understand and recognize the magic in your life, that magic exists. You know, you don't have to believe in literal magic to know that magic exists, whether we call that magic friendship, whether we call it love, whether we call it you know, loyalty, whatever there is, everybody has been the benefit of magic in their lives. And when you don't recognize it and you don't embrace it, there can be a price to be paid for it.
Right.
And I think that was one of the lessons in there, which was very, very personal to me. And I certainly, you know, and I think, you know, I think I made Passage for Trumpet the second lesson, which was a variation on, you know, follow your bliss, follow your dreams, follow your passion. You know, you'll be rewarded for following, because this entire book is an example of being rewarded for following your passion.
It's true.
And sharing it and not giving up. If you have a gift, which is what Gabriel says to Joey in that episode, that you have a great gift. You know, don't bury it under alcohol. Don't, you know, you have to, your obligation is to share it. Those two are not the first lessons in the book by mistake. You know, they are two very, very personal lessons to me, and very profound. Now, to me, there are also ones which are very personal to me because they're personal to all of us, because they have grown in relevance. And I think two of the episodes which have only increased in relevance since they first aired are The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street and The Obsolete Man. These are two episodes which, to me, have only increased in resonance. Rod's clearly writing about the McCarthy era and The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. He's clearly writing about what fear and paranoia and suspicion can do in driving us apart during that period. But as we've become more and more divided as a nation, we've become a nation that's more suspicious of each other and suspicious of people and don't listen to each other and don't talk to each other. That episode has become, the greatest cautionary tale to have emerged from. I think, you know, every American needs to be sat down and forced to watch that episode over and over again.
The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all of its own, for the children and the children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone.
Because I think it has the most harrowing lesson for our times, which is, you know, divided we will fall. If we do not find a way to get along, we ain't going to make it. We're simply not going to make it, which is what Lincoln told us, that a house divided will fall.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I think that episode, you know, the Twilight Zone sticks around because the lessons do seem timeless, and so they do seem relevant today. But certain lessons have taken on increased relevance because of what has happened in our country since it aired, and that's one of them. And The Obsolete Man is another, which holy mackerel! You know, for different reasons,
one of my favorites.
I mean, not only does it warn against the totalitarian state and giving up rights, and not only does it celebrate the worth of the individual, but it also celebrates the importance of the printed word. It also celebrates the written word. And that's under fire, but not from a totalitarian state. It's under fire by an internet culture, which has become the beast that eats everything in its path.
Right.
And, you know, we're getting to the point where, you know, libraries are social gathering places where they've had to put in coffee bars and computer bays in order to attract people into their libraries. And to me, you know, that episode has only grown in resonance because we are looking at the printed word being under fire,
right,
and the written word being under fire. So I think both of those episodes are very, very special. I know everybody loves the episode with Burgess Meredith with the broken glass.
That's right. I was going to mention that.
Time Enough at Last.
Speaking of books, right.
Yes. But to me, the book lover, the episode for the book lover, which is the more important, is The Obsolete Man. I like it better than I like Time Enough at Last.
This is Jim Benson. Join us next time for part two of our interview with Mark Duwadziak, author of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, right here on the TV Time Machine.